Hi everybody, I'm John Offord. I'm a broadcaster based in the UK and welcome to Different Minds, a podcast series that looks at neurodiversity, the different ways our brains can work and interpret information. Today we're going to talk about autistic spectrum condition and ADHD. I'm delighted to be joined by a very special guest. Susan Hodgkinson is 44 years of age, lives in the northwest of England and works in grant writing. Susan has a dual diagnosis of ASC and ADHD. Susan, welcome.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Surviving wet and windy weather.
It's not too good out there today, is it? Absolutely. So anyway, it's a bit of a blue Monday, but we'll press on with today's podcast. So I wondered if you could just tell me, first of all, what is autistic spectrum condition and ADHD, the two conditions that you have been diagnosed with?
Autistic spectrum condition is quite a good way of putting it. It's a different way of being in the world, and people who are autistic are different in that we process things differently. We have a different cognitive style. We have different brains. And one of the most common ways of seeing that people are aware of is that we are not really good at those social nuances and that social interaction that people seem to have naturally from birth. And we kind of have different ways of processing the world, and another way that comes out is in sensory sensitivities. So in a lot of cases, people will be aware of autistic children who cover their ears or who stim, you know, they rock, they comfort themselves with movement, and they can't bear different types of touch or different types of clothing. And we think in a very logical fashion, I think, is a good way of putting it. But when you add together those differences, they make up for being human in a different way and interacting with the world in a different way. And ADHD, I genuinely think that when the world moves on a little, ADHD and autism spectrum condition or disorder aren't going to be seen as that different. They're going to be seen as part of a wider neurodivergence, which is a different way of being within the human biodiverse spectrum. But ADHD comes with those things that generally are associated with it, impulsivity and hyperactivity. But a lot of it is about being able to manage day to day, so poor executive function and inability to settle to things is quite a key point. I saw a lovely paper about it once, which talked about people with ADHD are always wondering what's next, and that's kind of it. We're always looking for the next dopamine hit. There have been papers published on it that show brain differences in young people with ADHD and young people without, that are about those neurotransmitters that deal with dopamine hits in the brain. And that's one way of looking at ADHD, is that your attention span is poor because you're always looking for the next thing.
Can you tell us about when you were diagnosed with autistic spectrum condition and ADHD? I understand that you were diagnosed quite late in life. Is that right?
Yeah, it was 2 years ago I was diagnosed as autistic. And a year after that, I was diagnosed with ADHD. In both cases, I initiated the appointments and the diagnosis because I'd self-diagnosed before. And in both cases, it was about finding answers for how I'd been all my life that I hadn't seen reflected in people around me. I knew I was different. I knew I functioned differently. I processed differently. And for a lot of my life beforehand, I thought that this was an intrinsic deficit in myself. And then when I started reading about how autism can present in some people, oh, you read a lot about autism in women and girls, but it's just a different way of autism presenting from that stereotypical traditional view of a small boy and an obsession with trains. And when I went to my diagnosis interview for the autism spectrum condition and was diagnosed as autistic, it was a relief and a joy, really, to understand that, you know, I wasn't weird or broken or deficient. I was just different,
And can you tell us a bit about the ADHD diagnosis as well, Susan?
Yeah, that emerged from looking at my own autistic traits and realising that there is probably slightly more to that, and reading around how ADHD presents in adults and the lifetime of difficulties that people with ADHD can have with impulsiveness, with being unable to organise, unable to concentrate, unable to stick to a single task and so on. One of the reasons behind my ADHD diagnosis was looking for treatment for ADHD, because it was looking at making my life easier in dealing with those ADHD traits and the lack of attention and the lack of ability to concentrate on a day-to-day basis with work.
You mentioned before that you know what led you to get a diagnosis a couple of years ago. So, you know, did something happen a few years ago, or is it something that you felt that now was the time to be diagnosed? I just wonder how that came about at such quite a late stage in life, and if that's quite typical.
I know a lot of autistic people, and I know some who've been diagnosed as children in their 20s, and two of my really good friends who were diagnosed in their 70s. So I think a lot of people, and this is true for me as well, understand autism and ADHD in those very stereotypical media presented traditional ways, and they think that doesn't apply to me because I'm a woman, or I have a partner and I live independently and I have a job and I function, so I can't be that thing, while still wondering why they don't quite function in the world as well as they think they should. And for me, it was, I'd always felt that I was probably a little bit autistic. And then when I researched in my 20s and 30s, I came up against all this standard stuff that said autism is prevalent in boys and men. Autism is to do with science, technology and maths, all those STEM subjects. If you look at some of the questionnaires, which are there to self-screen for autism, they're about numbers and strings of information, and do you like a lot of trains. And when I read that in my 20s and 30s, I thought, that's almost me, but not quite. And then I read an article by a wonderful woman called Sarah Hendricks, who's also late diagnosed autistic. And I identified with it absolutely completely. And I did that at a point in my life where I was really struggling with my job because it required a lot of social interaction, a lot of meetings, a lot of networking. And I was really struggling because it had no routine to it. So I was looking for answers at the time, and then I read the article and from there went into a deep dive into the literature that's available out there now about being a late diagnosed woman.
And I wondered if you could just tell us a little bit more about what actually happens when you're diagnosed with autism. What, you know, you mentioned you go to see a GP. What actually happened? How are you diagnosed with autism?
Oh, there's several ways now. I went to my GP, who really wonderfully agreed with me totally, which I don't think is everybody's experience, particularly for adult women. But we looked back over my medical history and thought, yes, there's definitely something there. And I was referred to the local autism service, which for me, I was very lucky. That was in Lancashire at the time. It was run by a psychologist called Vicky Bliss, who is very keyed up on autism in women and girls and how those traits are demonstrated, and also how to diagnose somebody who is accustomed to masking. Because one thing that autistic people do is if we're undiagnosed, and generally to get by in the world, get by in social interaction, to deal with all you weirdo normal people who like talking to each other all the time, we learn a camouflage. We learn how to pretend to be normal. And one of the great things about my diagnosis interview was that Vicky was aware of this, and she was asking the right questions to get to the autistic traits that I'd hidden under several years of layering of acting being normal. And that diagnosis interview, I think it took her a couple of hours. She's got a set of questions that she needs to provide answers to hit a certain set of criteria. But it was a generalized canter through my childhood and teenage years, which she very beautifully managed to make an informal conversation where she managed to tick off those boxes as we went through. So we were picking up things from my childhood, from my play, from my social interactions as a child. And my sister came along with me and provided some of that background history from when I was younger.
And again, a similar question for how you were diagnosed with ADHD.
With ADHD, it was a very similar process, but I went privately. There is a waiting list in my area of 2.5 years for an adult ADHD diagnosis. So I asked my GP to refer me in January 2019, and I'm still waiting. I'm told it's probably going to be 2022 now, which is a bit of a long wait, particularly if you've got ADHD and you're quite impulsive and you want the answers now. So I went privately, and it was a very similar process. They collated background information from me and from my mum and my sister about my background and my childhood. And then we had an interview, which very much concentrated on teasing out those ADHD traits. But it wasn't a particularly difficult thing for me to go through, because I'd already picked out those ADHD traits because I'd been living with them for 43 years at that point and being very frustrated by them.
How did it make you feel when you got that official diagnosis? And I just wondered if there were any benefits of gaining an official diagnosis.
I felt vindicated. I don't think I would have been wholly happy just self-diagnosing. I wanted somebody else to confirm it for me, because I just wasn't sure enough by myself. And if you think about it, by the time I was 43 and got that diagnosis, I'd been reflecting on myself on many occasions and thought, why am I different? Why am I wrong? What can I tag this to? So I really wanted somebody else to look at my life with me and to give me that vindication. Now, I know a lot of other autistic people are quite happy to self-diagnose, and with years wait and waiting lists and so on, you can't really blame them for doing that, and that's fine. But for me, it was absolutely a vindication. It was a relief to know that, as I said, that there wasn't anything intrinsically bad or wrong about me. I just worked a bit differently. And so from that, I mean, there was a period of joy that was just, thank goodness, I know I'm different. I'm not bad or wrong or broken. It was a vindication. I mean, there were negative things that came after that. There was sort of a lot of anger and frustration afterwards, which was a lot relating to the fact that it took that long to get to that point. Because you can't help but look back over your life and look at all these god-awful mistakes that happened here, there and everywhere, and the times I've got social interaction wrong, and the times I've got things badly wrong in life. And then you look back and you think, but that was why. But if somebody had told me earlier, I might have been able to work with it better. But that's not actually been too hard to come to terms with, because there's kind of nobody to blame, because I grew up in Wigan in the 70s and the 80s, and there's no way anybody could have been expected to pick that up in a Catholic school in Wigan in 1980, that girls had autism, and also that bright girls had autism. They saw my ability, but they didn't see what sat behind it with the problems.
Interesting. And obviously you are incredibly self-aware. And I guess that, you know, that is not always the case, is it, with people that aren't aware of a condition that they may have? And I guess that obviously self-awareness is obviously a useful thing to have in this instance.
There's an interesting point there about how much more self-aware I became since I began that self-diagnosis process, looking at what other people had written about their similar process. There's some great memoirs out there now from adult autistic women who were diagnosed in their 30s and 40s, stuff like Laura James and Catherine May. And before that, I was aware that there was something that didn't fit, But I wouldn't say I had a lot of the insight that I have now. That insight has come with a deep dive into autism research and a lot of subsequent therapy. So
maybe you can just talk us through some of the coping strategies that you have.
Yeah, I've actually changed my life quite a lot since my diagnosis. I work from home now. I do a part-time week, so I have a little bit extra space for myself because I have a lot of caring responsibilities for my mum, which before I changed my working life around meant that I was doing sort of 5 days a week in the office and on top doing a bit of running around after my mum and then going home and collapsing in a heap because it was just all way, way, way too much. And the way my life works now, it's, I think from the outside, people looking in would think that it's quite a small life, but really it enormously works well for me. My ability to cope and my general levels of well-being of being able to cope are just so much higher. So I don't go into the office, which is sensory hell because the noise is atrocious in any given open plan office. I don't have to do that daily social interaction with colleagues, which is very difficult. It requires me to mask, requires me to do very funny things like keep a mental spreadsheet of who's got a baby and who's getting married and so on, so I can ask the right pertinent, interested questions. And it's that closing it down to be quieter. I don't have noise at home. I'm alone quite a lot of the day because my partner works out 9 till 5. So I get a lot of space for me. And I've always had a lot of friends, but they've always been online. In the good old days, in the late 90s, early 2000s, I was on discussion boards for women where we were talking about politics and books. And then we met up on the back of those discussion boards. So I never had to do those difficult initial contacts to make a friend. They were there ready made from being communicated with over the internet before we met, and that's basically how I've managed my friendship since. The internet is what brought me to the autistic community via Twitter, and I've met up with several late diagnosed autistic women through there as well. So the accommodations that I make for myself make my life a lot easier now. And I have disclosed to work that I've got autistic spectrum condition, and my manager's been absolutely great about it with the working from home and with understanding why sometimes I don't deal with it very well. If you change a meeting time on the day that it's supposed to happen, then I get quite panicky and upset about it because it's change, and we autistics do fear change. It's a terrible thing, change. So it's working my life around what I need, and what I need is a lot of quiet time and not very much sensory pain, which comes for me primarily from too much noise.
And you talked earlier about kind of looking back on your life and making mistakes, and I guess we all can identify with that. Mm-hmm. And you know, you talked about relationships and that kind of thing, and I just wondered, obviously you have that self-awareness, but I guess it also requires what you might call a neurotypical to have a better understanding of autism condition as well, in terms of it works both ways, doesn't it? And I just wondered what your thoughts were on maybe friends or partners that are, you know, what we call neurotypical, and you know, whether they understand exactly what autism is and what your kind of experience around that is.
I don't think I've ever had a neurotypical partner, but not by intention, but by default. I've had two long-term relationships, and neither of my partners has been neurotypical, and I pretty much think that's because we both in those circumstances phoned people with whom we were very comfortable with being weird together and being unsociable together.
Would you say it's perfectly possible for a neurotypical to have a relationship with someone on the autism spectrum?
I know lots of autistic people who do have successful relationships with people who are neurotypical, and I could imagine doing it I think particularly now with the insight I have into what I need to be well, what I need to not be exhausted all the time is basically the gist of it. Because if you're trying to be normal and trying to exist in a neurotypical world, it is exhausting. That's the ultimate effect. Mm-hmm. So I do, it does work perfectly well. I think it's like any relationship, you make your compromises according to the other person's needs. And I think that's how it works in the autistic neurotypical relationships that I'm aware of. The neurotypical person knows to give the autistic partner the space that they need, and the autistic partner knows that they need to communicate. Because that's the key point, I think, with anything neurotypical or autistic, working between that, is you have to work out your means of communication. I have that with my sister, who is fiercely and enthusiastically extrovert and neurotypical. And we've kind of missed each other through our lives, if you see what I mean. We've never wholly grasped each other's personality and maybe misconstrued what the other meant or what the other's actions meant. But now that we know to compromise for the fact that we work so very, very differently, then that relationship is much, much better. I can play to my strengths, and she doesn't turn up randomly on my doorstep to talk to me at 7 o'clock in the morning, which obviously sent me into a raging meltdown.
I was wondering what your thoughts were on kind of the media portrayal of autism, because as you touched on earlier, often is a very simplistic view of autism on British television. Take maybe an example of that is The Undateables on Channel 4. Often they feature people on there with autism spectrum disorder, and maybe they have Asperger's. And then people get confused sometimes with the different terms, high functioning autism, Asperger's syndrome, autism spectrum condition, and they're not sure exactly what it means to have that condition.
I think they're getting better, but that definitely doesn't mean they're anywhere near there. I think they'll be there when they have an adult woman who's managing to run a life and a family and be autistic simultaneously, because I know quite a few who do that. It's not ideal, the media representation, because it does re-cement those stereotypes, and it re-cements those stereotypes that it's around boys. It's around boys who have an additional learning difficulty or a learning disability, and it's focusing around either laugh at the weirdo or pity the disabled who need social care. And they don't seem to be making any of those roads into an ordinary person yet, because that's what autistics are. We are just ordinary people. I mean, if you look around in any university or IT service, you're probably surrounded by autistic people, but you don't really see that in the media yet. What I do find really encouraging, though, is that we are getting people. We are getting coverage now of people like Greta Thunberg and the women who are writing, like I said, Laura James and Catherine May. They may not be in mainstream media yet, but you've got them, you've got Hannah Gadsby, you've got Sarah Gibbs, who writes for Channel 4. And these are all people who are publicly autistic. And so that is starting to come through. It might only be in a Here's My Life interview piece in The Times or The Guardian. It's not getting through in mass media yet, but it's starting to change. So I feel quite happy about the potential, if not with the current media representation. And the other problem with the media representation is it's something that I said when I was diagnosed, and I've said to a friend who's just working to get her daughter diagnosed at the moment. If you can't see it, you don't know that you can be it. So, you know, my friend who's getting her daughter diagnosed was really poo-pooing the idea that her daughter could be autistic, because her daughter was bright and clever and social, and, you know, she didn't seem to have major problems in school. There was just this bit and that bit that made her think twice about maybe she had a developmental disorder. And we said the same thing. If you don't see these things, then you don't know that you can be part of that, that you are that.
Interesting. And just to go back to ADHD then, I wonder if you could just tell me more about kind of life after being diagnosed with ADHD and how that's been for you.
I have prescribed stimulant medication, which is the usual first-line treatment for ADHD, and it has immeasurably improved my life because I can actually sit down at my desk at 8 o'clock in the morning and work, and I don't have to fight myself to concentrate on what I'm doing. So the difference with the ADHD medication has been absolutely amazing. It's not the be-all and end-all. I did think it was for the first month I was taking it, because the difference between before and after was just so seismic in the amount of work I was getting done, which then obviously had an amazing effect on how happy I was at the end of the day. But you do need to do a lot of work alongside, and you need to do a lot of accepting of the fact that you're never going to manage to achieve everything and manage everything. And I was laughing to a friend the other day. It took me an hour and a half to go out of the house because I had three errands to do, and I just could not get together. I was returning a parcel, I was picking up a prescription for my mother, I was doing something else, and I needed about three different things to leave the house, and I couldn't do it for an hour and a half because I just couldn't get myself organized. Part of the benefit of the diagnosis of ADHD is the forgiveness of that in yourself as well, because previously I just thought I was a hopeless human being. You know, I looked around at my peer group and what they could manage and thought, my God, I just can't cope with the most basic everyday ordinary tasks. What's wrong with me? So the post-diagnosis of ADHD is the benefit of the medication, and also that understanding that comes from the realization that, you know, you need to learn to live with the difficulty, and you need to accept that, you know, you're doing absolutely brilliantly if you get through the day with half a day's work done and maybe a couple of household chores, that somebody should give you a standing ovation for that.
So how are you coming to terms with your autism diagnosis?
I'm very lucky in that I found an absolutely excellent therapist who has a lot of personal experience of autism and is quite up to date, because the information that's coming out from research that's being done at the moment is much more pertinent than the previous research that has been done that gave us the extreme male brain theory of autism and all of that, all of that absolute rubbish about lack of empathy and having no theory of mind and so on. So my therapist has been brilliant, because what she's helped me to do is come to terms with the anger and frustration that came out of the diagnosis, that was me looking back at my life and going, realizing why I'd failed at jobs and realizing why I'd failed at social interaction and why I'd always felt that I was running so very hard to catch up to people who seemed to be so effortlessly moving through life, making friends, going to things, having fun. And I just always felt slightly shut out from that, and I'd never understood why. And so coming to terms with that, and coming to terms with how to live now to make myself well and to cope well, has been absolutely invaluable to me. It's something that I really think we're short of in this country, is that sort of level of post-diagnostic support for adults, which is about learning how you are autistic, because obviously not all autistic people are the same, and there are so many different traits associated with autism. There's the sensory, there's the social interaction, there's having a fixed way of being, there's fearing change, there's enormous anxiety that comes with living in a world that isn't made for us. And there's something definitely needed for adults who are diagnosed to sort of gently introduce them into this is how autism can impact on a person, and these are some of the things that can go with it, because there are things like alexithymia, which is where you have feelings, but you can't name them, you can't identify them. And that was something that was picked up in my autism diagnosis interview. And it's something I've struggled with all my life. I actually spent a period of time thinking that I was a defective human because I didn't have feelings, because I couldn't name those feelings. I thought I was some kind of sociopath who didn't feel. So it's about picking those things up, all these things that make up a parcel that then becomes an autistic person, and how do they work within that single person. So that's kind of how my therapy has gone, has been very much about making my life better and understanding how I tick, and roots around things like the alexithymia, because it becomes problematic when you're reacting to something. And I spent a long time thinking I had a real problem with anger, and it's only when I was able with my therapist to get down into the nuance of what I was feeling and why I was feeling it that we realized that it's not anger, it's fight or flight anxiety. It's when things change around me, my emotions go off the scale and I can't function. And I was seeing that as coming out as anger, and thinking I had this terrible anger management problem, I was a terrible person, and I was going to, you know, end up, I don't know, being medicated for aggression. And then you get down into that nuanced detail, and it's entirely something has changed in my life that I wasn't expecting. I've had an enormous spike of anxiety that's turned into fight or flight, and that's why I feel as though I am actually angry, which I'm not. So that is the kind of therapy that is really needed post-diagnosis, particularly if you're an adult, because you have just so much to unpick about what is you and what is the mask you've presented to the world.
Susan, I wonder if I could just take you back to, you mentioned before about theory of mind and empathy, and you said something about absolute rubbish. Can you just tell us a bit more about tell us what is theory of mind as well, and what do you mean around what you just said?
There are two very enduring myths. I don't really want to call them myths. They're based on research done in the 80s and 90s, and they contribute to this sort of stereotypical media type view that people who are autistic don't have empathy, they don't feel for their fellow human beings. And theory of mind is related to that, and it's talking about how can you put yourself in other people's shoes. And one of the, I don't even know whether to name him or I'll get told off, but Simon Baron Cohen, who was doing a lot of research into autism, developed this idea of theory of mind that is the ability to see beyond self, is a very, very simplistic way of putting it. And he posited that autistic people couldn't see beyond their self. So they couldn't understand that people felt differently from them or were different from them. And they couldn't see why their desires perhaps would have to be compromised to get on with other people. And subsequently, the theory of mind thing has developed a little bit, and now it's known that, you know, everybody needs to learn it, and we just presume that neurotypical children learn it a lot earlier than some autistic ones, because we have what is called a spiky profile, which sounds quite cool actually, but it is basically we learn things and we're good at different things. So I am absolutely brilliant at my job and terrible at organisation. And it's about the speed you learn things and whether you fully learn them. But basically, this idea that autistic people can't empathise or can't have fellow feeling or can't understand other people's problems, it's been shown subsequently to be absolute rubbish. And there's a great researcher doing a lot of work on this at the moment called Damien Milton. He's autistic, he has an autistic son, and he's talking about something called the double empathy problem. And that is that neurotypical people think that autistic people don't have any empathy or feelings because they don't see us display them in the way they expect to see them displayed. And in the same point, autistic people look at neurotypical people and try to participate in their conversations and their social interactions, but we just don't get it. because you're operating on a wholly different system to what we are. So it's a mismatch. It's a mismatch of communication. And the whole empathy thing has come about from something that's been problematic in autism research for a very long time, which is you have autism researchers looking at what they can see from the outside. And if what they see from the outside is a child who wants to line up their toys and doesn't want to play, they go self-centered and in their own world and completely internalized. Instead of asking the autistic child, what are you getting out of lining up your toys? And the answer would be, enormous amount of joy. Come and do it with me. Isn't this fantastic? So that's the problem with the assumptions around these terrible stereotypes that say we have no feelings and no empathy and we can't have full human relationships. It's about understanding how autistic people display their feelings. You know, we don't do it in a way that neurotypical people expect.
Would you say there's still some misinformation out there then?
Oh, there's still huge amounts of misinformation out there. It's starting to turn slightly, but the autism research field at the moment is still dominated by people talking about autistic mice and trying to get a genetic code for autism. There are a lot of practices that are about teaching autistic children how to not be autistic, which is not really entirely helpful, because that's basically what I did. I taught myself how to appear not autistic, and as a result had a whole series of nervous breakdowns from my teenage years onwards. So that it's not moving as fast as it should be. There are people doing good work, but there is still a reluctance to listen to autistic people when we say, yeah, you might be saying that's what it looks like to you, but why don't you listen to us about how this feels to us on the inside? I mean, there's still some of my friends who didn't believe, who were very surprised to discover that anxiety was a key part of autism, because they didn't see autistic people as being anxious. They saw us as being closed off and capable. And it's even small nuance like that where we might appear closed off and capable because that's how we're presenting in that situation. But you can genuinely believe that if we're out in the world, we are raging with anxiety inside.
Susan, we're coming towards the end of the podcast now. I just wondered if you had any advice to anyone that was listening that may be thinking they could be autistic, or thinking about whether to go to see a doctor about a diagnosis or not, or aren't quite sure what to do. I just wondered if you had any advice for anyone listening that was in a situation like that.
I would say read. Read and read things by autistic people. I've mentioned them before. Laura James's memoir, Catherine May's memoir, Damien Milton's work. Read things by autistic people. And if you want that vindication of a diagnosis, go and ask for it, because it is through the diagnosis that you will get the post-diagnostic support. It's really patchy, but there is some out there, and that is what people really need when they're coming to terms with a late diagnosis of autism. And also find your tribe. I've never, and until I was in my 40s, I had never met another woman that I could sit and talk to for 3 hours comfortably. And then I met late diagnosed autistic women via Twitter and went out and met them for coffee and cake and dog walking and whatever. And I have never felt so at home in my life as talking to other autistic women. It was just, find your tribe. These are the people who have had the same life experiences as you, and there is something so enormously wonderful about finding that when you've spent 40 years wondering why your life experiences don't mirror that of your peer group or what the media tells you you're supposed to be doing or feeling.
Susan, thank you so much for talking to us today. We really appreciate it, and you've been so open and honest, and I know that what you've had to say today will go a long way in helping others listening to this that are perhaps going to suit through something similar. And yeah, just really, really enjoy speaking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been great. It's been really interesting.
Brilliant. Right. Well, you take care. And the thought of coffee and cake sounds pretty good. So I might go and have some right now, actually.
That sounds like a good plan.
Thanks again, Susan.
Thank you.